Welcome to Life and the Vision. I'm your host, Brett Humphrey. In this episode, we hear about, name me one thing that's more important than Braille at 15.
Everything.
And this?
It was great until I missed a couple of glass door dividers. Girls don't think you're very cute when that happens. They think you're weird.
Maybe a little bit of this.
There's nothing better than playing guitar on the back of a boat, strumming a six string.
So let's dive in and get going.
Tony has a crazy story. It's awesome.
No, it is.
I feel like Doctor Who, though. Like, I've kind of regenerated several times.
Well, that actually sounds important because it's a theme that I've recognized in talking with people. Because Eric's commented about it, his transition into college was kind of a time to reform a bit.
I think being blind makes you adapt. And I think adapting is a really good quality when change is handed to you. You know, life, major life changes. You know, you learn early on how to get yourself out of a jam or just how to stay calm when you get lost. You have no idea where you are. And sometimes life can sort of hand you that in a sense where you feel lost and you don't know where you are and you just got to remain calm and weather it and know there's another way out. You know, going back, so I've been legally blind my whole life. I never saw good enough to where I could drive. We didn't even know I was almost blind until I was like four. I had a genetic birth defect called X-linked retinaschisis. But they didn't know anything was wrong. They thought I was maybe developmentally delayed because I wasn't looking people in the eyes or talking to them. And I was real slow at trying to learn letters. And people would say, you know, pick that up. And I couldn't see it. But then they found out, you know, it was detached retinas. And then when I was 15, I went total from another side effect called acute angle closure glaucoma. So that killed the one eye I could see out of. And I went 8 years and then they were able to do a little bit of like a kind of some stuff to my left eye that lets me now see like in one eye, like a pinhole in a box, like shadows and some shapes, something like really close. I can't read or anything really, but it's, you know, it's better than being in the dark in a sense. But it, you know, pretty much my whole life, it's been, you know, a life knowing that it would, you know, when I was a kid, they were like, this could happen to you someday. And so I went through the whole school system, you know, with teachers for the visually impaired, TVIs, as we call them. But I was not a good student. You were talking earlier about grades. But part of it too was, I mean, I think the vision was always kind of the easy excuse. You could always say, well, I don't see good. So that's why I have no interest in doing my homework.
Yeah, my stepmom busted me one time. She goes, "You're not dumb, Brett. You're just being lazy."
Yeah,
oh, that's harsh. She goes, "Come on now, get your
Yeah, but I had a lot of other things going on. Like my home life was very fractured as a kid. My dad walked out the door. I remember when I was five. I'd still see him as I got older, but it was always like once a month he would get visitation, but he would flake and bail on us or something like that. And so, you know, from those years of growing up, a boy kind of figuring out what does it mean to be a man. I didn't have really my dad around other than the occasional holidays or, you know, 1 or 2 weeks in the summer he would take us and we would go on these crazy campouts up in the wilderness. He was a ex-Vietnam sergeant in the Marine Corps and we'd go like pull the car off on the side of the road by some creek in North Georgia. I was born in Atlanta, as you can tell by my thick Southern accent. And that got beaten out of me in the Midwest and New York.
Definitely New York.
Yeah, definitely yes. New York. So, but as a kid, like you know, we
even
would pull
to New York. With
he
the
did,
right
yes.
We would pull over these streams and just basically you dig a latrine, you throw your food in a bag and throw it in the stream. We would fish, and, you know, and eat the fish and cook the fish, you know, and all this stuff. Wow. So, I mean, I was very much a survivalist, which is completely with my two boys. Now I have a 6-year-old and 8-year-old. Has drawn me into loving fancy hotels. I should say fancy for me. Fancy is like a, you know, a Courtyard by Marriott or something. But, you know, a hotel with a buffet in the morning is like, you know, like I'm living like Beverly Hills.
Yeah. You don't make him grab a bag and head
exactly.
up to the stream.
I don't have to dig a hole and I hope I don't step in it later because I can't see good. So, you know, but yeah, so you know, growing up for me, it was that challenge. I did not have a high drive. There was never any pressure. Neither of my parents went to college. My father learned everything in Vietnam, but he actually ended up working his way up to be the head of Latin America for AT&T, director of operations for all of Latin America. And so he rose, but it was, I think it was sort of a Marine work ethic. And his father was a horrible alcoholic where he grew up. And so he had PTSD and just was real kind of a forceful man, which actually, after I went blind, I wouldn't live this way to my own children. But I mean, his sort of forcefulness kind of steered me, I think, in a way to say, yeah, I can, you know, I'm not going to let this, you know, crush me in a sense when I was 15. So that was real positive. And it actually, as hard as he was growing up, he moved to Mexico when I was graduating high school. And it wasn't before I went blind, I wanted to be a roadie for Van Halen. Like, that was my goal.
Oh, nice work.
Yes.
I was playing guitar and then picked up, there was another guitarist in our band. So then I started to play bass. And so I got really into bass guitar. I remember when I went blind, you had to take this test where it was like, put these blocks and they'll time you and like from one section to another and all these things to see where could we put you as a blind person in life? You know, do you want to go work in a factory making cans and brooms or something like that? And, I was like, no, I just want to be a roadie for Van Halen and just, you know, play music. It wasn't until I went blind and I had a teacher who really changed my life and kind of for the first time showed me I could be something. I never even thought of college. And I got involved in writing and ended up, you know, I think because I had such a strong imagination, maybe it was because after going blind and just trying to keep everything in your head and hold on to it so they're not fading away, you know, I was a good writer and got into journalism and, went off to college on journalism scholarship. I had two paths to take. I could either go major in music, I had a full ride in music to a couple of schools.
Wow.
And then I had scholarships in journalism. So I chose journalism. I think to try to please my dad.
Oh, I thought maybe you were going to say trying to go for Rolling Stone.
No, that would have been
still,
nice.
You know, meet Van Halen.
Exactly. So. I could be the next generation Cameron Crowe or somebody. But yeah, so I got out into college and actually I was horrible in high school, like my grades. I wasn't flunking, but I wasn't doing great. I was a 2.0 kind of student as well. And
yep.
But when I got to college, I kind of soared, you know, and people never really held anything back. Like nobody ever said, you can't do this. The only time I ever had a hard time was I took Russian as my language for some crazy reason. I thought I spoke Spanish because my dad lived in Mexico. I was like, I know Spanish, you know? And so I was like, I'll learn Russian, you know, just to be different. And I had this old Soviet professor, Pavel Petrovich Popov, at the University of Georgia. And he forced me to write in Cyrillic. And so I got to where I could write in Cyrillic better than English. Like I had forgotten how to, because I was doing Braille and I forgot how to write in my handwriting in English. So I could write better in Russian. And so, but then while I was in college in 1994, my father was working in Mexico City and fell into some bad hands with the Mexican Federale soldiers. Mexico was going through some real upheaval a couple months before, you know, the presidential candidate was assassinated. There was a lot of unrest in Mexico, primarily because what was going on with the Zapatistas in southern Mexico. And my father was living in Mexico City, and there was not a lot of friendliness towards American expats that were working down there. And so he fell into sort of the wrong hands with some federal soldiers, the Federales, and they basically beat him to death. And so that was a breaking point for me. And from that point since, I've pretty much been working on social justice issues, like in everything that I've done. That sort of created a passion that there was something outside of me. You know, it totally crushed my ego and selfishness of any college student. You know, you're in college and you're supposed to be thinking about, you know, yourself the whole time and how you can have fun. But that kind of got turned upside down. So, you know, I kind of went from being, you know, somebody that wanted to sort of stoke my ego and go off and be a famous sort of journalist somewhere, to how could I maybe be a catalyst to change, social change. And so I finished my undergrad and then graduate in journalism and mass comm as well. I went to the University of Georgia and got into radio, ran a small grassroots sort of nonprofit radio station while I was in college. Found I much more preferred talking than writing, primarily because I always got frustrated with editors because they're always so picky about your spelling. And when you can't see your spelling, it's horrible. Oh. So I hated that, you know?
So it's a show.
You read Braille,
I'll just talk all fancy. No. Gosh, and then you'll think, that's fine, you know? So if I talk fancy, I don't want to get spell check errors and editors that just nerve me.
Oh, man, one of my professors in college, he made some smart-ass comment in class. And then he knows that I basically write phonetically. Mm-hmm. And so he'd replied in an email and everything was spelled 100% wrong, but 110% correct for phonetic. And I was just laughing. And I'm like, nice. Thanks.
Well, yeah. I always used to joke that you could, you know, you could tell which blind people knew Braille and who didn't. Because those who were really fluent in Braille were good spellers. And those yep. who
yeah,
are not.
Braille. I tried learning it at the same time. I was 15, so I had much more in my mind than Braille.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, name me one thing that's more important than Braille at 15.
Everything.
Oh my gosh. I had to start learning at 12, I wanted nothing to do with it, along with learning how to use a white cane. And oh God. It was great until I missed a couple of glass door dividers and bounced off of those. Girls don't think you're very cute when that happens. They think you're weird.
Or when you take their knees out with a Perkins barrel, it's like 50 pounds. You're slapping it around. But when I finished grad school, I sort of took a big career change and walked away from broadcasting. I had some opportunities in broadcasting that would have been, you know, more commercial, and I wasn't really into that. So I signed up to go be a priest and went in the seminary because I sort of had my own experience in Mexico around the time my dad died and after he died. That was very sort of because my dad was an atheist and I grew up an atheist, sort of in his footsteps, just no religion after Vietnam. He couldn't believe in anything.
Yeah.
So I sort of had this spiritual conversion in Mexico right before he died and then afterwards. And so I wanted to be like the Paul Simon song, Me and Julio, you know, down in the schoolyard.
Yeah.
When they say, when the radical priest comes to get me released, we were on the cover of Newsweek. And I went to this sort of spiritual retreat with this guy that was Mother Teresa's confessor. He was a Jesuit and just very charismatic person, you could probably imagine. And so Jesuits is like a Catholic religious order of priests. And I kind of was like, you know, this is for me. I want to be the guy that goes out and fights, you know, kind of the underdog. And so I left and spent 7 years. But then I realized, wow, this is really lonely because you're not allowed to get married. And even though you live in a house, you know, I was in a house with 20 other dudes, it can get kind of lonely still. You're still very isolated. And so kind of wrestling with that, I left. And I was living in New York for a while years before and moved back to New York. And that's where I met my wife. And so I'd been working sort of in, you know, I was working in sort of social justice oriented nonprofits, some human rights work and a lot of communications work since that was my background. And then moved down to DC after we had our kid and we realized schlepping a stroller when you're blind up and down subway stairs is no way to have fun.
Well, I was just going to ask that because literally 2 days ago I was hauling gear for the podcast previous to this. And tried to jam some stuff through the turnstile and ended up catching myself right in the crotch.
Yeah. So that's happened a few times. Trying to chase my kids through a turnstile or something.
Yeah, caramba.
Yeah, that wasn't fun.
I'll catch up. Keep going. I'll be there. Yeah.
Yeah. But how's New York just single? Like, I'm asking, sorry, side question.
I love New York single. You kidding? It was Yeah. I still love New York now.
Coming out of being a priest?
I moved to...
You probably went buck wild.
I only had a sip of wine.
One.
Just the one. I've never been a hedonist per se. My addiction has always been like guitars and things like that.
That's awesome. Do you still play now?
I do still play, yeah.
That's awesome. Okay, I'm going to do some recordings when I come back.
Yeah. So New York was great though. I still love it.
The reason I was wondering is that... I think New York gets a bad rap for people being rude, and I don't think it's true at all.
No.
That's exactly it. They're like, get it, because it's faster to walk than it is to drive down those streets. Yeah. That was my observation. But everybody was super nice, and it didn't matter who I stopped. They would always answer a question. Like, I don't know. I really have a lot of love for that city.
Some of the best people I know are still back in the city. And it gets a bad rap because everybody thinks it's Times Square. Is all in New York. But, you know, I lived in Brooklyn after our kid was born. We lived on the Upper West Side.
Yeah.
So.
I guess if you don't mind, felt like you've been through a lot in being in New York and then coming here. Why the transition from New York to here?
My wife is from here, and we don't have a lot of like family. Both my parents are gone. My mother passed away just a couple years ago, but I just had my mother, and I got a sister, but you know, we're kind of getting more close after my mother died, but that's kind of past couple years. But so like 8 years ago, we left New York, and I think it was just to be near her father, like just to have some sense of family. When you have kids, I got some family in upstate, like cousins, you know, in New York City, and she had a brother in Brooklyn as well, but her roots are here in Maryland and outside DC. We got married in Baltimore. We now live in Baltimore. It was as close as I could get to feel like I'm in New York City without quitting my job.
Right.
So, you know, it was just, I don't know, just that sense of just, you know, kind of wanting to think of, you know, I think thinking of family and her family and just, okay, well, here's, you know, I want my kids to have some sense of family. So they got their grandfather. That's all that, you know, her mother passed away years ago too. So I think that was probably why. I was kicking and screaming when we took the U-Haul over the George Washington Bridge, leaving Washington Heights where we lived.
Yeah.
But this is home now, you know.
So do you work with the ACB, but do you do other work as well outside? Because you said your focus is a lot on social justice. So I'm just kind of curious how it fits.
I got into the blind biz, so to speak. You know, I always was a self-advocate, but I came to DC and took a job for a very large nonprofit, right? I got lucky and got a great job leading communications for a very large nonprofit. And it was the worst experience of my life. Like so much that if it wasn't for my 4-month-old, well, at this point he was maybe 10 months old. When I left the job, I wanted to jump in front of a train, waiting on the train every day. Like it was just hell.
Yeah.
Like the boss told another employee, she didn't know what to do with me. You know, after she hired a blind person, she regretted it. She would post signs up instead of the email saying, hey, let's go to happy hour. She would put signs up just, you know, I couldn't see it.
Oh my God.
So it was just hell. And then I was press, like not press secretary, but I was kind of the like a role of a press secretary for the CEO who was just crazy.
Yeah.
The CEO of this nonprofit. And so, you know, I was like, man, if I've had, cause I had amazing opportunities before this in New York and all other places. And I was like, if I've had this many opportunities and this is hell for me, what is it like for other people? So that's how I got into sort of blindness. I started working for another nonprofit that focused on employment of people who are blind and the guy, that's how I got to know Eric. And so when I came here, it's almost been 3 years, I guess, hasn't it, Eric?
Yeah. It'll be 3 years in January.
Which is only 2 days into my job. I got hit by a car. that was a good start to a job. Whoops. I love my new job. It's great. Bam. Funk. And walking home from work one night. But, you know, you know, knowing Eric and just having a passion, because I'd worked on immigration, I worked on healthcare, a lot of big, you know, I was really into Latin American politics. I still am, but, you know, just because of my father's death and refugee work and things like that. And so, you know, I've always worked in that space. And so I still do some work now. I help out, you know, there's an adaptive sailing program I've started to volunteer with up in Baltimore. I've actually started to learn how to sail myself.
That's awesome. I got some friends that are hardcore sailing people.
It's addictive. Man, it's addictive. So it's taken my attention away from guitars to now dragging my wife to the U.S. boat show the other day. Going, awesome. I think we could live. This is like our apartment in Brooklyn. It's not that much bigger, you know?
Yeah, she's like, no.
Well,
a buddy of mine in Seattle, he and his wife were living on his boat for quite a while.
Yeah.
And they just got a house, but he loves to sail and they have two different boats and they had their dogs and lived on it. And
it's a romantic, I've always felt like that idea of an explorer, you know, kind of being blind.
Well, I just figured you'd sit on the dock of the bay.
There is that. There's nothing better than playing guitar on the back of a boat, strumming a 6-string. So
yeah,
but no. So yeah. So
that sounds like a podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. See, I like this. But there's lots of things going on.
Yeah.
the thing, that's one of the sense of people's time because we're over the initial time that we were going to sit and chat. But the thing I appreciate about one having a freeform conversation is that there's an interesting theme that arrived in my mind today, really just about just transitions and going through them, because everyone here had a very unique transition point where they had an option to kind of go forward or take a different path. And what I think is great to hear about all of the things today is that I got to hear things that for like things for me that are kind of, it's inspiring to me, but I think it's also just awesome to hear what people have been through and where you are today, because I suspect for me personally, I would not have ever expected I'd be sitting here doing this podcast, you know, from when I'm 45. So I wouldn't have expected to be sitting here doing this today, you know, and taking the route I have in life. But it's a pleasure to be able to sit around the table and chat with you all today. And so thank you for that time. And any thoughts or closing thoughts today? I'm happy to sit and talk longer. I'm just trying to be respectful.
I mean, you just
made
me think of one thing. I mean, sometimes the shortest distance between two points is by taking a different route. You know, I mean, it's interesting to hear Eric and Rebecca's story because we talk shop all the time, but not, you know, too much our backstories.
Mm-hmm.
And it is interesting, you know, it is a common thread about change and ending up where you didn't think you'd start up. Actually, mm-hmm. I think has moved me a lot more forward in my life. I mean, I'm extremely, there's nothing more exciting than, where was I? I was at a mall the other day and someone wanted to lay hands on me and try to heal me. And I love my life now. I love my kids. I love my family. I love my wife. I love my job. Mm-hmm. You hear that, Eric? I love my job.
No. I got you, man. Love having you here.
No, but you know, it is, you know.
But I think that's how you get to that. Yeah. Like you have to have these other experiences to shape you. And I don't, you know, it's funny. I mean, our disability, I don't think defines us, but it has a profound impact. Because we just experience things a little bit differently, and maybe
it's about what you do with
right. I mean,
crap that you encounter.
We have choices to make in life, and I think that's very powerful. And that's, you know, what I hope to teach, like our son, that, you know, when you're faced with adversity or challenges, you have a choice. You can you know, bow and kind of wither, or you can confront it, and you may not be able to confront it in that moment. I mean, there were times in my life I wasn't able to confront those
things
in that moment.
Yeah,
but I came back to them, and I think that's important to, you know. And I think Brett, you have a cool gig. It's cool. It's fun to know you and to be a part of the podcast.
It is great.
And know you in other ways.
Brett's got a cool job.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
You know,
see previous podcast.
See footnote and show notes.
Yeah, that's right. See show notes for that. Let me tell you, my you know what my gig's going to be for the next month? Editing. That's what's going down for the next month.
I didn't think we talked that much, did we?
Yeah. Thank you all for joining us for this episode. Audio engineering is done by Brett Humphrey. Audio production is done by Cody Kilpatrick. This episode is copyright 2018, all rights reserved.